today I would like to introduce Dr. Michael Yardom, Director of Infection Prevention and Control for the University Health Network in Toronto. Dr. Yardom has been through, I think, at least two outbreaks of Norwalk in his facilities in recent years and is called upon regularly to give lectures on the topic. Many of you have been through this experience or are in the middle of it now, so we'll try to leave as much time as possible for you to ask your questions toward the end of our hour. So on the topic of management of a Norwalk-like virus outbreak, I give you Dr. Michael Yardom.
Thank you very much. What we'll do is we'll start off with the slide entitled Outline, and we'll go from there. So we'll briefly talk about Norwalk basics and review of the epidemiology of Norwalk, and I'm hoping that'll only take about 5 or 6 minutes, because I really want to get into the actual case studies, and then we'll go through sort of some general recommendations for Norwalk-like outbreaks. So the Norwalk viruses, as you know, they've been around for about 30 years. They've now been renamed the noroviruses, so you may hear about that in the literature. Moving on to the next slide, these are a member of a larger group of non-enveloped viruses. And right off the bat, as we'll talk about later, non-enveloped viruses are bad news when it comes to infection control because they're much harder to kill than the enveloped kind. As you can see from that slide, there are three groups. Groups 1 and 2 infect humans. Moving on to the next slide, we all know the clinical features. Probably everybody online has probably had this at some point in their life. So I'm not going to talk too much about that. I just want to point out on that clinical feature slide that the viral shedding can actually begin prior to the onset of illness and can actually go on for a lot longer than people thought. It has been reported going on as long as up to 14 days after the end of symptoms, and you can shed virus without any symptoms at all. So that has some implications when you start talking about outbreak control. Going on to the next slide, the diagnosis, as you know, is largely a clinical one. However, we certainly, in Ontario anyway, we can send our samples off to the public health lab for electron microscopy, but most of these outbreaks are simply diagnosed clinically. Moving on to the next slide, the pathogenesis I'm not going to talk too much about, it's simply to say that although the actual illness only lasts about 24 hours to 48 hours and you feel better, people often have symptoms that go on a fair bit longer than that. And it's not unusual to basically still have some diarrhea or some malabsorption or upset stomach for up to 2 weeks after the illness. So the acute illness is quite short, but it can go on a bit longer than that. Going on to the next slide. In terms of immunity, the key point with immunity is that it's not perfect. And so you can get infected with a strain, and if you get exposed to exactly the same strain within a few years, you'll probably will be protected. But if you get exposed to a different strain, there's a very good chance you're going to come down with illness. And even if you get exposed to the same strain, if it's more than a couple years later, your immunity can very well be gone and you will get sick again. So that's why this occurs over and over again. Moving on to the next slide. This is a key slide, relative resistance to disinfection. You have to use a fair amount of bleach if you want to kill off the Norwalk virus. Again, that's because it is an enveloped virus. And it also is sensitive to 2% glutaraldehyde if you were trying to high-level disinfect something. The key thing that has come out very recently is that accelerated hydrogen peroxide, or the compound is called Virox in Canada, definitely does appear to kill off Norwalk-like viruses. For example, the feline Khaleesi virus, it definitely has an effect against that. It's also cidal against polio, which is also an enveloped virus. So this is something which is very, very useful, because here is an environmental cleaner disinfectant which actually can take out a lot of this virus. As you know, it's quite heat resistant. It is sensitive to boiling, but heat resistance comes in when you're talking about foodborne outbreaks. Things like phenols and quats are not that reliable in terms of trying to get rid of this. So from our perspective, you're basically left with either bleach or you're left with accelerated hydrogen peroxide. It's also quite resistant, going on to the next slide, to antiseptics. And so, for example, alcohol-based hand rinses have kind of a plus-minus activity against enveloped viruses. And so You know, in an ideal world, if you had sinks available everywhere, washing your hands to just, you know, physically remove the virus is probably the way to go. Most of us don't have sinks everywhere, and so we do rely on alcohol-based hand rinses, and we use them a lot, as you'll see in our outbreak management. I think they still have a very important role to play because they're obviously far better than nothing. But they're not going to have the same activity against these viruses that they might have against MRSA or other bacteria. Key point here is that chlorhexidine is really ineffective. Chlorhexidine is really going after the viruses that have a lipid coat. Okay, going on to hand washing, as I've said, hand washing is probably, well, for sure it is the most important means of controlling this. Going on to the next slide, this is a slide from the CDC, and you can see that when they compiled 348 outbreaks, a good number of these were actually foodborne. A small percent were waterborne, and a good chunk were also person-to-person. And so this has multiple modes of transmission. Going on to the next slide, key point here is that the infectious dose is less than 100 viral particles. So that's one of the reasons why this transmits so readily in healthcare institutions is that it does not require very much to infect somebody. Moving on to the next slide, foodborne transmission I'm not going to talk about, simply to say that it does occur. Next slide, waterborne transmission. Similarly, you can see that you can get this from well water, from swimming pools, from ice. And the normal public health testing that's done on water is not going to pick up Norwalk because they're really looking for coliforms. So there's really no assay for Norwalk, and so if it's there, you're not going to see it. You're only going to know because people get sick. Moving on to the next slide, this is, I think, one of the key things for us, person-to-person transmission. Fecal-oral transmission through direct contact with stool and vomitus is by far the most important means. And you'll see that when I talk about our outbreaks, how that occurred. Indirect contact via fomites is also extremely important. We know that Norwalk viruses can live in the environment for at least 12 days or so. And so that person who came into your emergency room can be long gone, but their Norwalk is still all over the place unless you've actually cleaned up that room very well. When people have bad explosive vomiting or diarrhea, you can obviously get transmission that can occur over longer distances, i.e. greater than 1 meter. People have talked about this perhaps being airborne. I would rather think of this virus as something which it certainly does seem to aerosolize if people vomit or they have diarrhea, and it can certainly get all over the environment so that people can pick it up from the environment, perhaps quite a distance away from somebody when they vomited. We don't have the same studies that we have for other airborne illnesses like tuberculosis, where you can put two people in rooms side by side, and they're only connected through the ventilation, and you can still transmit TB that way. We don't have that kind of evidence to say that this is airborne in the true sense. So in summary, going on to the next slide, Norwalk is nasty for many reasons. It has a low infectious dose. You can be infectious before, during, and after symptoms. There's multiple modes of transmission. It's stable and quite resistant to disinfection. And finally, there's multiple antigenic types with poor immunity so that you can get it over and over again. So moving into the case studies where I'll spend the majority of my time. So the first case study actually occurred at the Toronto Western Hospital about 2 years ago. In December 2000 on two medical units, and basically we had a patient who presented with classic Norwalk symptoms around December 5th. Over the course of the next 3 weeks, we had 70 patients and staff who developed infection, and the infection was far more in staff than in patients. And really, this was really an equal opportunity virus. It took out nurses, physicians, house staff, various consultants, housekeeping, radiology, support staff, etc. Many, many staff got sick. Relatively few patients got sick. Moving on to the next slide. We felt that the transmission in this circumstance was facilitated by a number of things. First of all, food sharing at the nursing station. As you probably noticed, Norwalk activity seems to be peaking right around just before the Christmas holidays. And so it's very common on nursing units for people to bring in plates of cookies or candies or whatever. And you can imagine if you've got one person with Norwalk or about to get Norwalk symptoms, who may have Norwalk on their hands, who has their hands in the same bag of potato chips as somebody else, you can obviously get a lot of potential transmission between people. So food sharing, I think, has played a role in a couple of our outbreaks. Similarly, most nursing units or hospital floors may only have one staff washroom for women and one staff washroom for men, or it may be shared. And so if your staff get ill, which washroom do you think they're going to use? They're going to use that one. And so given what I've told you about how tenacious Norwalk is, how long it hangs out in the environment, you have to assume that even if that washroom has been cleaned by housekeeping on a regular basis, unless they have literally scrubbed it down with something like Virox over and over again, there's going to be Norwalk virus in there. The infectious dose is very low, and so you're going to get transmission through that washroom. Another problem we had was staff cross-covering wards, and this is an age-old problem. While your nursing staff may be relatively associated with one particular unit, your medical staff, your medical residents, radiology, etc., cross units all over the place, and so they can obviously bring it to other people. Another one that we found associated with this outbreak was non-medical staff socializing with patients. With our Toronto Western outbreak, there was actually somebody from chaplaincy services who was a very friendly fellow who wanted to meet and greet everybody on the floor, and he would go from patient to patient on the floor, shaking everybody's hands and making sure they were okay. You know, 24 to 48 hours later, he was out with Norwalk, and that sort of took care of that. But the reality is that you really have to look at those kinds of contacts. Moving on to the next slide. Control measures. So what we did with this is, which I think everybody would do in this circumstance, is we had to basically close the medical unit. This was predominantly on one unit, and we closed it for 2 weeks. And what closing means was there were no admissions, patients were only discharged to home, there were no transfers in or off of the ward. And that was something that we did in conjunction with our operations people at the hospital. And I really can't stress that point enough, is that in infection control, although we think we all know how incredibly important we are, we actually in reality don't have a lot of power. And so we can advise, and we advise our hospital in terms of what we think we should do. And by and large, the hospital listens to us. But strictly speaking, it's not up to us in infection control to actually close something. We discuss it with hospital administration, and they're the ones who do the actual closing. And I think that's a very important distinction, because that's how we get our operations people on side. They're involved in the decision. They're the ones making the decision on our advice. And so when people start getting upset, et cetera, saying, how come you're not open again, this is a decision that was made, you know, not by us, but by our hospital administration on our advice. We obviously got rid of food at the nursing station and in common areas, and that's a very tough thing to do. People like to have their common food, and so, but we were very, very strict about that. There was supposed to be a potluck lunch for the staff on the ward, and we obviously canceled that as well. Moving on to the next slide. One of our key things with Norwalk, and I think with just sort of the concept of universal precautions or body substance precautions, whatever you want to call it, is that we assumed everybody had this. Even if people weren't ill, they could be ill 24 hours from now, or they may be recovering, or as we found with a lot of our medical residents, they are ill, but they won't tell you. There's actually a phenomenal sense of duty some people have. They don't want to miss their rotations, and so even if they're sick, they may not tell you. So we assumed all patients and staff were infectious, which meant that we strongly enforced hand washing between any contact. It didn't matter if it was patients, if it was contact with patients, if it was contact with a doorknob, if it was contact with another staff member, any sort of touching of any shared equipment or shaking someone's hand, we insisted on hand washing after that. We used gowns and gloves for any patient contact, and that meant whether or not they had Norwalk, everybody went into gown and glove contact. The problem with that kind of policy is the fact that then the tendency is for people to wear the same gowns and gloves and go from patient to patient to patient. So we had to make it very clear that no, that was not the case. And so we would be up there all day making sure that people weren't doing that sort of thing. We also really pushed the use of alcohol-based hand rinses. We used Cida rinse at that point. We had Cida outside every door. We had it when you were greeted to come onto the ward. We had it in the nursing station. It was everywhere, and we just took pump bottles from everywhere else and put them in there to make sure that, you know, you could never argue that you didn't have enough Cida rinse. In terms of education, we did in-services with the staff there. We handed out pamphlets to the staff and to the patients telling them what Norwalk was and making sure that there was nobody there that didn't know what they were supposed to do. We allowed our ill staff to return to work 48 hours after the end of symptoms. Now, one of you asked a question before the conference about how long do people actually have to be away from work, and this is a very, very tricky issue because, well, first of all, in Ontario, when we close, public health also enforces our closure. so that even if we wanted to open up 2 minutes after the last symptoms, we wouldn't be allowed to. They would hold us to that 48 hours. So part of the 48 hours is actually out of our hands. That being said, we know that there has been transmission that's occurred from cases that have been later than 48 hours after, but honestly, you can't keep a medical unit closed for that long. I think the 48 hours thing is reasonable. If people are back to work, not sick, using the toilet and washing their hands, obviously, I am really not concerned that they're going to be transmitting this to anybody. One of the key points here, though, is that what if you don't have enough staff, and even the 48-hour thing means you can't man your unit? That's a very tricky issue. We had that issue with our second outbreak that I'm going to talk about, where we ran out of medical residents, and we didn't have enough medical residents to cover the hospital over the weekend. And in one of those cases, I allowed the senior resident to come back to work 24 hours after his symptoms were over, basically on the pain of death that he had to promise me he was going to be washing his hands every 5 seconds. So that 48 hours thing, I think, is a relatively fast rule, but I think you have to be practical. And there may be circumstances where you might have to bend that somewhat, because the alternative to this is not keeping is keeping a ward closed for another day or an emergency room closed for another day. And if there's a huge press of patients which potentially might be harmed due to your closure, you have to take that into account. But certainly staff can't work if they are ill. I would want at least 24 hours from the time that they are symptom-free until they come back, and even then I would really try to push that to 48. One of the key things that we did with our outbreaks, and I see with our second one as well, was extremely aggressive environmental cleaning. What we did is we got teams of housekeepers who would basically go through the nursing unit, staff washroom, and patient rooms multiple times a day. So they would basically start at one end, start cleaning, and they would be using 0.5% accelerated hydrogen peroxide, or Virox. They would use that starting at the sort of one end, and they would be going through the entire unit, turn around, do it over again, turn around, do it over again, and they would do that multiple times a day, whether or not something looked dirty. And so that was, I think, a really key point to stopping the transmission in this outbreak. Because, as I said, it's everywhere. You have to assume everything you touch on that unit is covered in Norwalk virus. And so it doesn't matter if you send your staff home or not, because there's still tons of Norwalk floating around that someone else is going to get. So I think that's a very important point. Moving on to the next slide, the outcome of that particular outbreak was we didn't really have a lot of spread to patients off the outbreak unit. We had about maybe 5 or 6 patients who got ill clearly from nosocomial transmission, but there were several more that came in with it from the community. That's what started this off in the first place. And we didn't really get spread outside of the outbreak unit to patients. Staff on other units got ill, and these were staff who were cross-covering onto the outbreak unit. And so that really brings the issue as well, is that ideally, in an ideal world, those staff wouldn't be allowed onto the outbreak unit. But honestly, if someone needs an EKG or needs radiology, or needs a cardiology consult, you can't not let them have that. Those staff have to come in and do that thing, but they might get sick. In areas where you actually can limit staff going in and out, that would be an ideal thing to do. So at the end of this, we had no further cases in staff or patients after 2 weeks. The lessons learned, at least that I certainly learned from this, was that get hospital administration and public relations involved early. Because, again, this has huge implications on how your hospital or your facility runs. It gets into the newspapers very, very quickly, and you have to be ready for that, and you have to be ready to take the heat. And it's very helpful if it's not just you taking the heat, but it's also your hospital administration taking it. Environmental cleaning played a very, very important role in this outbreak, and I think that us treating everybody as infected also helped to some degree. Moving on to our second case study, this just happened a month ago. Basically, again, just before Christmas, involving our emergency departments, one at the Toronto General and one at the Toronto Western. And what we saw was a dramatic increase in the number of patients with Norwalk-like symptoms started showing up to the emerge in early December. So people would come into the emergency room. They were usually young ambulatory people, actually, vomiting in the waiting room, in the triage area, in patient care areas, and in the nursing station. There was a lot of vomiting going on. And what I've told you about this virus, you can imagine that's kind of a setup for some sort of disaster. If you look at the next slide, which is a graph, basically, if you look at the percentage of patients presenting to the emerge with Norwalk symptoms, you can see that around the 9th of December, 15% of all patients coming into the emergency room at the general came in with Norwalk symptoms. And so our staff, over a 5 or 7 day period, were basically bathed in patient after patient coming in with Norwalk. And you can imagine that no matter how well you wash your hands, nobody's perfect, and eventually you're going to catch this. It's just a matter of time. Moving on to the next slide. At the Western, which was also experiencing similar waves of patients coming in, they had had sort of a steady, small stream of staff going off sick for more than 1 week in early December. So every day I would hear from the Toronto Western that one or two emergency room staff had gone off sick, but it was never a whole bunch at once. It was always one or two every time, and so 3 days later or 4 days later, those staff could potentially be back at work again. At the General, we didn't have staff off sick until that 5 day period between December 4th and the 9th when 18 staff became ill very, very quickly. So for whatever reason, the General seemed to have been overwhelmed very, very quickly, whereas the Western was more of a slower, small number of people going off sick every day. And basically, the emergency room at the General had to close because we had no more staff. So many of them were off sick that we didn't have enough physicians or enough nurses to man the emergency room. Going on to the next slide. In terms of patient illness, between the 5th and the 19th, 22 patients with Norwalk symptoms were admitted to the General Emergency Department. All of these were believed to be community acquired. So basically, not only were they getting hit with patients coming in who were then going home, but they were also requiring to actually admit some of them to the eMERGE, some of whom actually had to go to medicine to be treated, others of whom were there for a day or so to get rehydrated. And so now they're not just coming in at the doors, now they're also in beds throughout the emergency room vomiting. And so again, that's a perfect setup for getting this transmitted. One of the things that got us very worried, and which was one of the reasons why we had to close, was the fact that two patients who were seen in the eMERGE for something other than Norwalk came back 24 to 48 hours later with Norwalk, and most likely, given the state of our emergency room, those people picked it up in the eMERGE. So now we had nosocomial transmission to others, which is one of the things you look for when you're talking about, you know, when are we going to close? So in our circumstances, closing the eMERGE was based on two factors, that nosocomial transmission and the fact that we ran out of staff. Moving on to the next slide, we quickly formed an outbreak team, and we had twice daily meetings. And I think a key point of this is that this was chaired by operations. This was not chaired by infection control. Operations ran the show. We advised them, and they did whatever we suggested to do, because there's no reason for them not to do what we're suggesting. But I think, again, a very key point is that the decisions to close, the decisions to move patients are their decisions, and so they feel very comfortable if they're the ones making them. They feel less comfortable if they're being told to do that. So we had representation from infection control, from ID, obviously, housekeeping, public relations, our eMERGE staff. We also had people coming from our sister hospital across the street, Mount Sinai, and from the Toronto Western emergency rooms, because that's where our eMERGE patients are going to go. If we close our doors at the General, our patients are going to go somewhere. They're going to go to Sinai, and they're going to go to the Toronto Western. And so they had to be prepared for it. And as I already told you, the Western was kind of hanging on pretty thinly at that point, because this one or two staff a day were getting sick. And so they had to know about it. And obviously, as with all outbreaks like this, public health was involved as well. So what kind of control measures did we do? Well, the first thing we obviously did once we had no staff was we closed the eMERGE. And similarly, as before, there were no patient admissions from the eMERGE elsewhere. Those patients, the only place they were allowed to go was home. Now, interestingly enough, even after we closed the staff and had multiple visits with the staff in the emergency room, and they were all aware that we were closing, two patients were still admitted after we closed. So that was in direct sort of contradiction to what our orders were. And that happens. And so what we did is when we heard about them, we immediately went up to the wards where they went, isolated that patient and the patients they were in with, and basically they were cohorted together over the incubation period of the Norwalk virus. And fortunately enough, we didn't have a great deal of transmission from them. Interestingly enough, before we closed, a patient was admitted from the eMERGE and went to our coronary care unit and then proceeded to have terrible nausea and vomiting and diarrhea. And actually, I think at the end of that, managed to take out about nine nursing staff with Norwalk because they just had projectile vomiting all over the place. So again, those patients that are being admitted with Norwalk, they are like little ticking time bombs, and you have to treat them very, very aggressively to make sure that it doesn't spread beyond them. Another thing we did at the General and at the Western was that anybody going into that emergency room, there was actually a security guard there greeting them at the door and requiring them to use alcohol-based hand rinse on entry and on exit. If they were going to be doing patient care, they were immediately given a gown and gloves before they were even allowed in. A lot of people use emergency rooms as sort of an easy way to get outside of the hospital. They walk through the corridors and it's closer to the parking lot or whatever. We put a stop to all that. We didn't want anybody just walking through the emerge. They had to have a very good reason why they were there, or else they had to go around. Moving on to the next slide. In terms of control measures at the General, the other thing we did is, and this is from our previous experience at the Toronto Western 2 years ago, those of you who work in teaching hospitals know that when the cardiology teams comes down, there's actually about 8 of them in it, and there's a staff, and there's a couple fellows, and there's a bunch of residents, and a couple medical students. The last thing you want is those 8 people in your emergency room. They don't need to be there. So we would insist on only one person, basically pick the unlucky person is on call to the emerge, and only them. They go down and see them, and then they come back, and they will then tell the staff physician what's going on, or if the staff physician, whatever. But only one was allowed. Like with the Western, we assumed that all areas of the emergency room were contaminated, so that there was no part that was considered clean. Whether or not the patient who was in that room had Norwalk symptoms or not, we just assumed everything was contaminated. All patients and staff were considered to be infectious as well. So again, like before, hand washing essentially all the time. Doesn't matter whether you saw a patient or not. Obviously, food was prohibited in the emergency department except for patients. We couldn't starve them to death down there, so they got food, but nobody else did. Gowns and gloves for all patient contact, and again, strict removal of gowns and gloves between patients. We, again, tried the very aggressive housekeeping approach where we cleaned and re-cleaned all areas of the emerge. Now, our emerge is relatively new, so we have a lot of single rooms which have glass doors which close them off from the rest. So once the room was empty, the patient had gone home or whatever, we would clean the entire room. This would also involve actually throwing out of supplies from that room. So if there were supplies which were sitting on a countertop or were in drawers that would have been opened and closed during the outbreak, we got rid of all of them. We threw them out because we assumed those are also covered with Norwalk. And we basically, the entire room was cleaned, the curtains were washed, etc. And at the end of that, the door was closed and a big sign was put on saying clean. And that room was never used again until we opened our emergency room. And so as patients were discharged, that's what we did. We would go through and do that. And in the meantime, we were also going through and re-cleaning the nursing station over and over and over again. We, again, encouraged hand washing with soap and water or alcohol-based hand rinse. Although I think hand washing is probably the ultimate way to go here with soap and water, the reality is you don't have enough sinks, and alcohol is far better than doing nothing. Last point on that slide, we definitely limited visitors. In most cases, we wouldn't allow them in at all, unless, of course, someone was very ill, and then for humanitarian reasons, of course, they were allowed in. But even then, they were basically escorted to the room. They had gowns and gloves on, and then they were escorted out again to make sure they didn't touch anything. And I think that helps a lot for many reasons, not just the fact of spreading the organism around, but also that the staff are obviously very harassed when they have an outbreak, and visitors are one thing that we actually can limit, and I think it's an important thing to do. During this outbreak at the General, we monitored for Norwalk activity everywhere else in the hospital, so in staff and in patients, and 44 patients that were admitted from the emerge between December 5th and 8th, so that's sort of the 4 days just before we closed, we followed them for Norwalk symptoms and basically kept a close eye on them until after the incubation period. We had many sporadic cases in staff. At one point, I was probably hearing about 6 or 7 staff a day throughout the hospital who were getting sick with Norwalk, but there wasn't a lot of evidence of clustering. In the medicine residents, there was a bunch of them got sick all at once, so presumably they may have all gone down to the emerge at the same time or shared food or whatever. The CCU staff, as I talked about. And another group that we were very worried about was dialysis. We have a very large dialysis unit at the hospital, and a couple of our patients came in with Norwalk from the outside, vomited in dialysis. We had nosocomial transmission in our hemodialysis unit to other patients and to staff, and we were very, very concerned about this because, well, you can close an emergency room, you can't close a dialysis unit. These people have to have dialysis, and there are not other dialysis beds around for them to use. So similarly to what we did in the eMERGE, we cordoned off those areas. We made sure that people who had symptoms were only in one area. They were only dialyzed in one area. Again, we limited visitors, et cetera, et cetera. And we had a very shaky week in dialysis where I was really afraid we were going to have a very large outbreak, but it never actually materialized. I'm hoping because of our efforts to isolate people and, again, because of the aggressive environmental cleaning that we did. Going on to the next slide, when the Toronto General closed, obviously there was an impact on the Toronto Western eMERGE. And so the Western, which had been seeing a bunch of patients every day, now saw even more with viral gastroenteritis. And we were very concerned that the Western was going to fall next, and then both of our emergency rooms would be closed. Up until that point, it really hadn't affected the Toronto General patient population too much because they were going to Mount Sinai eMERGE or going to the Toronto Western eMERGE, and if they needed to be admitted, they would be admitted directly from that eMERGE to the ward at the Toronto General. So that actually worked out okay. But if we were to close the Western as well, now we've lost both of our own emergency rooms, and that was going to be a big deal. So we were very concerned about that. Moving on to the next slide, what we did at the Western was we basically divided the waiting room into gastro and non-gastro areas. And so we brought in these partitions, and if the first thing you did, if you walked in the eMERGE and looked kind of nauseated, is you were put in the gastro side. Those people had a washroom dedicated to them. They weren't allowed to use any other washrooms. It was rather revolting to watch this. At one point, we ran out of kidney basins, and they were actually using Sharps containers, empty ones, of course, to vomit into. But I hate to be graphic, but you can imagine what a potentially dangerous situation this is, because that's all over the waiting room. We again restricted admittance using a security guard at the entrance. We basically closed other entrances using caution tape so people wouldn't walk in. They would have to go through the one door that was open where the security guard was. Obviously, the areas with caution tape, you could still use them in the case of an emergency if there was a fire or something, so we weren't breaking fire code, but we strongly discouraged people from using those. We cohorted the gastro patients. If they had to be admitted to the eMERGE, they were cohorted in one area so that even if they were sick, they wouldn't hopefully be spreading it to other patients, and we also dedicated staff to that area. So that these were staff inevitably who had just had the virus, and so presumably it's the same strain, so they won't get it again. Moving on to the next slide. Again, we limited visitors. We had a volunteer runner who basically went from the inside of the eMERGE to the outside to tell the visitors what was going on. And that way, it was only one person. They knew what they had to do in terms of hand washing, et cetera, and the visitors were still getting updates on their family member status or whatever. Again, we didn't allow any food for the staff. The other thing the Western did is they overstaffed. So they had enough staff left over that they could actually add on more staff so that everybody had time to wash their hands, they had time to put on the gowns, et cetera, et cetera. Because as you know, there's becoming more and more infection control literature saying that if you're rushed or if your GRASP score is very high on a unit, you're far less likely to comply with these measures. So overstaffing, I thought, was a good idea. Finally, there was education in services and flyers and signage, and there were daily updates that would be brought from the eMERGE to infection control and also to our outbreak meeting at the General. Going on to the next slide, basically after 5 days, our emergency room reopened, basically because staff were able to come back to work and the eMERGE had been completely cleaned. Outbreaks that we worried about in other parts of the hospital never happened. We had small little clusters like in CCU and in hemo, but nothing ever really went wild. At this time when all this was going on, I was asked by the hospital if we should still have our annual Christmas party, which would be for all staff, and we've got several thousand staff here at the Toronto General, all staff sort of buffet-type dinner. And in the midst of this outbreak, I had to say that I advised them not to do it. Given the amount of illness we had sporadically throughout the hospital, I felt that, you know what, it would probably be fine, but if it's not fine, you would have a phenomenal outbreak from that, and I just thought that it wasn't worth it. So we actually postponed our overall hospital Christmas party until sometime in February. And based on these measures, the Toronto Western managed to avoid actually closing, which was a very big deal for our patients. Moving on to the next slide. So the outcome of all of this is that once the outbreak was over at the General, we were still seeing a lot of Norwalk patients. I mean, it wasn't like they suddenly stopped. We were still seeing 5 or 6 a day. And so the General went from outbreak mode to containment mode, where basically although we were open, we divided our waiting room into a vomiting versus not vomiting area, and all the same things that the Western did, we did here at the General to make sure that we didn't have another outbreak right after that. After about 2 weeks, and this is again like the week before the holidays, the burden of disease really started to decrease. And so we could start lessening off some of these things. We didn't need the cordon off the waiting room, et cetera. And then I think the key point of all of this is that the outbreak overall had a very minimal negative impact on patient care. It really didn't harm our patients very much because we were able to keep other emergency rooms open around us. Lessons learned from that outbreak, having administration run the outbreak is a really important thing. I really can't stress that enough. We came away from this saying, you know what, in retrospect, we should have done what the Western did in terms of cordoning off patients and things like that. We should have done that a few days before we had to close. That would have been the smart thing to do, but not having really a good grip on what was happening in the community, et cetera. And the Emerge was doing some control measures, but I think in retrospect, now that we've learned, we're planning for next year that when we start to get a few cases coming in, we're going to be very aggressive right from the very beginning. And I think the close communication between the other hospitals really helped keep them open. And I really can't stress that enough. I think it was very, very useful. So in summary, going to the next slide, Norwalk outbreaks are one of the worst outbreaks you're going to have to manage. Fortunately, they don't cause a lot of serious disease, although certainly rarely people will die from this. If they have a very weakened immune status, or they may have a very feeble heart, et cetera, or they may be in with pneumonia, getting Norwalk can be just a thing to sort of push them over the edge. But by and large, it's a very difficult thing to control. The only good news about it is, as I said, most people get sick, but then they get better again. And I really believe that if you use very aggressive measures, you can certainly prevent the outbreak from spreading to other areas of the hospital. And I think the literature supports the notion that it's difficult to prevent transmission within the outbreak area. I think we were able to do that to a fair degree, but when you've got that many patients in your emergency room vomiting, honestly, it is going to spread. You can't completely stop that, but all you can try to do is limit the spread. In summary, I'm just going to finish up with this last slide here. I think a lot of our staff on this slide had a huge role to play in this, and you don't see very often that people in infection control actually thank their hospital administrators, but I think in this case, they actually did a very good job along with everybody else, ensuring that things worked very, very smoothly. Last thing I wanted to say is when we go back to the slide several slides ago talking about the enveloped versus non-enveloped viruses. I may have tripped over my words with enveloped and non-enveloped. Just to be very, very clear, enveloped viruses have a lipid coat, and because of that, they're relatively easy to kill because lots of disinfectants or hand washing things can take those lipids off. Okay? As opposed to non-enveloped viruses, which do not have a coat, they're much, much harder to kill. And I think when I was talking about that, I may have switched the words enveloped and non-enveloped around a few times. So anyways, at that point, thank you very much.
I'd like to ask one question. Just if you are the only hospital in town, in Toronto you have several.
Right.
In Bancroft you have one.
Right.
Or in many other cities you have one. If you are the only hospital, you cannot close
right.
your emergency department. What are the key measures to take when you have to stay open?
Right, and I think there you're in a situation like our dialysis unit, where simply closing is not an option. And really, I think the key measures are staff that are sick, they really can't work. That's one thing. No matter how short-staffed you are, if your staff are vomiting and with diarrhea, I don't really see how they can work. The next thing would be is that you're going to need a lot of help. If you're going to stay open, you might have to staff from other parts of your hospital, which, again, you have to bring the administrators in. Perhaps you can pull some nursing staff or some physician staff from other sites. You may have to close other parts in order to keep your emergency room open. And then the use of very strict hand washing, barrier precautions, and I think things like very aggressive environmental cleaning. So you're just cleaning over and over and over again. We were able to do that at the Western, despite which was a phenomenal amount of Norwalk. We were able to keep things contained that way.
In closing, before we do hang up, I want to thank Dr. Gardam for his effort and his time, and thank all of you again for joining us on this teleclass. Thanks very much. Have a great day.